You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. Tonight on Right on Radio, Dave Fettig talks with Tammy Lee, a children's librarian for the Ramsey County Library. Tammy joined us in March to discuss books on anti-racism and civil justice for young readers, and she returns tonight to share a list of adult books on the subject. Tammy received her MLIS from St. Catherine University and has many professional certifications. She has written about and facilitated many workshops and discussions around equity, diversity, and inclusion in libraries and collection development.
And I'm Noah Topliff. In the last part of the hour, Annie Harview talks with Maggie Shepstead. She's the New York Times best-selling author of Seating Arrangements, Astonish Me, and Great Circle, and the winner of the Dylan Thomas Prize and the LA Times Book Prize for First Fiction. She is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and a former Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford, and the recipient of a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. She lives in Los Angeles. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Okay, we're on. Hi, Tammy.
Hey, David.
Nice to have
you
back.
How are
you? I'm great. So great to have you back again. And to all our listeners out there, you want to wake up grandma, you want to get the kids and gather them all around the stereo console because it's going to be a great show. Tammy is back. So, Tammy, you were here in March, and we talked about books relating to anti-racism, civil justice, and related themes for children and young adults. You're back to talk about books for adults on this similar subjects. And I'm going to turn it over to you right now.
Oh, okay. well, when I was looking for some things to add to this list, I came across a great article, and I'd like to read a selection from it. It will take about 3.5 minutes. That's okay.
Take your time. The
title of the piece is "When Black People Are in Pain, White People Just Join Book Clubs." Oh. You might be like, oh.
I can't wait.
A librarian is reading this to us?
Yes.
But it is a great piece. It's by Trey Johnson and was published in the Washington Post on June 11th. If you're looking for it online, the full article online, and you hit a paywall, you know you can always access it, the full text, through your through the Ramsey County and other metropolitan libraries through their ProQuest subscription. So you can get this one for free at the library, among many other things.
Great reminder. Thank you for that reminder, Tammy.
Yeah. So I'll just get started. I'm 10 and watching my grandfather's back stiffen and shrink as an officer pulls us over on the way home from the mall. I'm 16, face down on the hood of a cruiser in Ewing, New Jersey. I'm 22 and sitting in the back of a car at night with my palms pressed against the driver's seat headrest in an empty lot off of Feeder Road outside Houston as two officers shine flashlights in our eyes. I'm 36 in a mainline Philadelphia neighborhood, crying in my car when an officer taps my window because someone in a nearby house has called about me. I'm 42 and watching the news of George Floyd, the latest racial killing, unspool across TV and social media. And as I watch, I am 10, 16, 22, 36, all over again, all at once. I'm also experiencing another time loop, though. Once again, as the latest racial travesty pierces our collective consciousness, I watch many of my white friends and acquaintances perform the same pieties they've played out after Trayvon, Eric, Sandra, Corinne, Both, and Brianna. They are savvy, practiced consumers of meaningful things. They've listened to Serial and become expert critics of our broken criminal justice system after just one system. This is all to say that when things get real, really murderous, really tragic, really violent or aggressive, my white liberal educated friends already know what to do. What they do is read and talk about their reading. What they do is listen and talk about how they listened. What they do is not enough. This isn't the time to circle up with other white people and discuss Black pain in the abstract. It's the time to acknowledge and examine the pain they've personally caused. This is the racial Ouroboros our country finds itself locked in. As Black Americans, we live an endless loop of injustice, and white Americans keep revisiting the same performance, a Broadway show that never closes, just goes on hiatus now and then. This is our own racial Ouroboros. The chaos we see now stems in part from the chaos foisted upon us for generations. The injustice we protest isn't rooted in just police killings. It also lives within housing and school choices, school and professional networks, the defunding of non-white organizations, the demotion and firing of Black employees, the microaggressions and slights that happen at dinner parties, restaurants, cafes, and concerts. The right acknowledgement of Black justice, humanity, freedom, and happiness won't be found in your book clubs, protest signs, chalk talks, or organizational statements. It will be found in your earnest willingness to dismantle systems that stand in our way, be they at your job, in your social network, your neighborhood associations, your family, or your home. Comforting as it may be to read and discuss the big questions about race and justice in America, making up for past wrongs means starting with the fact that you've done wrong in the past, perhaps without realizing it at the time, in the old workplace, neighborhood, classroom, softball field, maybe even the book club. The confusing, perhaps contradictory advice on what white people should do probably feels maddening. To be told to step up, no, step back, read, no, listen, protest, don't protest, check on Black friends, leave us alone, ask for help, or just do the work. It probably feels contradictory at times, and yet you'll figure it out. Black people have been similarly exhausted making the case for jobs, freedom, happiness, justice, equality, and the like. It's made us dizzy, but we've managed to find the means to walk straight. On my stroll to a voting place on election day in early June, I rounded a corner of City Hall and saw not only 24 armed National Guard troops, but a Black woman slow riding her bike in wide, dreary circles that created a miniature Ouroboros, bringing her closer and closer to the fence line of soldiers that drew me in too. As she completed her first arc, I was able to read the sign taped to the handlebars. In red, white, and blue letters, it read, "No, you do better."
Wow. So, Tammy, remind us of the title and the author from the Washington Post, the piece?
It's called "When Black People Are in Pain, White People Just Join Book Clubs."
And the author?
And it's by Trey Johnson, T-R-E, last name Johnson. And it's from June 11th. Okay. Washington Post.
So much to unpack from that, Tammy, because here we are talking about books.
I only read part of it.
Yes. Yes. We'd be here all night if you read the whole thing, I'm sure. So there's some irony here, of course. We're here to talk about books, mm-hmm. as you suggested. So let's start there. We're here to talk about books, and yet the point is so well made that is not enough. But what can books do, given what we've just heard and given your own thoughts, please?
Kind of like what I was saying when we were talking about children's books and like some of the programming that we've had here in the library, and I know it's been in other libraries. Ashley Ullman with Allied Folks, she does workshops with children. And one of her main focus points around anti-racism is giving children language. And I think... when we're talking about like having those conversations, and hopefully they're compassionate conversations, but having those conversations, you have to have the lingo, the vocabulary to do that. And books and book clubs and discussions are all valuable things, because you need to have the language to be able to discuss what is happening in the world. And I was just listening to Dr. Otis Moss, and he was talking about, it was just great. He was talking about the peculiar, the peculiar mix of insecure arrogance and willful ignorance that makes up white supremacy and racist and white supremacist systems.
Right.
And a way to combat that is to know what you're talking about, to not continue to be willfully ignorant. And that's what book clubs do for us. That's what reading and learning on our own, whether it's racism and white supremacy, or it could be addressing biases against other marginalized communities. It's always good to know how to talk and have those tools about the things that need to change.
Can book clubs, let's stay on book clubs here for a minute, can they give us a false sense, and this was suggested in the piece, of doing something when that's really not?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, they can, if that's the only thing you're doing. One thing that I was talking to a local reporter around the George Floyd decision, and we were talking about how I'm a lifelong Minnesotan. Most of my friends and family are white, and I know that they genuinely care I know that that is something that they want to change and that they work on, but there is also the matter of comfort. Nobody likes to be uncomfortable, and heavy topics like that make us uncomfortable. And so one way to get more comfortable with them is to like read and talk and think about them. But we can't just, you know, choose to be comfortable again. Right. We have to keep going. We have to embrace the discomfort of that to be able to overcome it.
So let's begin, let's continue this by talking about some of these books issue. And I'll just speak here and say for myself that I've read a number of books in the past year and a half, like many others. And I will say that How to Be an Anti-Racist by Kendi, which is not without controversy within the Black community itself, but really spoke to me about how to do something, how to go beyond reading books. What does that mean, and what can a white dude like me do? And it's not, it doesn't take that much, but it's still hard. These little things that you do, that you, at any rate. If you want to talk about that particular book, or if you have others you want to talk about, and please, I would encourage you, if you want to read any snippets along the way, Tammy, please do. Let's start with How to Be an Anti-Racist. I don't know if you, you know.
Well, How to Be an Anti-Racist, I think it's a very popular book. You're right, it's controversial on its kind of qualification of what constitutes racism is probably one of the biggest controversies in the book. But overall, I agree. It's a great book. And his other title, too, Stand From the Beginning, which gives us a great foundation for the history of whiteness. And actually mentioned in the piece that I read, I'm going to forget this. There's a radio show that is good. It's a 14-part radio show. It's just slipped out of my head. That does a great job of talking about the creation of whiteness, happened at the same time that the concept of Black was created. So I think I like that Mr. Kendi or Dr. Kendi addresses those history and that occurrence that, you know, that has been kept from us in that book. It's been around for a few years now, and I'm glad that it's still being read and that it's still popular. Like it. It's a great book.
This may be a good time.
The other one that's been around for a while that I like because it's about our community is A Good Time for the Truth, edited by our own local poet and author, Sun-Yung Shin. That's a great book.
That's really
nice. You're literally reading about your neighbors, you know, and their experiences, people that you wouldn't have expected. You know, these are the people that you rub shoulders with, and this is their experience that is so radically different than yours, you know. So I think that's a great great title. Some other ones that I pulled aside. One thing that I've been thinking about a lot is especially post-verdict of the murder of George Floyd. Obviously, the killing of Philando Castile, the people, you know, named in this article, the murder of George Floyd, those are horrible things. And they contribute to this just impossible, untenable situation in the world right now. But not to lessen those occurrences, but what also occurs every day times a million are those, and that's one thing that I kind of liked about this piece, is the injustice that happens locally, the injustice of a small-minded, mid-level manager that packs a peanut butter sandwich and racial bias at lunch, and chooses not to advance BIPOC or people from marginalized communities, things like that. And I think that's much more accessible when we're thinking about our culpability in perpetuating these systems, whether they're, you know, racist or sexist or, you know, that sort of thing. And so there are some books that I really liked that are on the list. One that I read last year is Mothers of Massive Resistance, White Women and the Politics of White Supremacy. Librarianship is often, it's not compared to social work, but often librarians like kind of cross that line a little bit. And so it was really a familiar book, talking a lot about social workers and teachers teachers and, you know, kind of those womanly, those stereotypical yeah. womanly professions.
Right.
And how white women have perpetuated in these small ways. They've done more to perpetuate Jim Crow than the actual people that, the men that made the Jim Crow laws.
Amazing.
And so it was amazing to me. I think I gasped a lot during the book.
Wow.
But Mothers of Massive Resistance by Elizabeth Gillespie McRae. Excellent read. We have a lot of social services in Minnesota. We have a lot of social workers and teachers. I think it would be a very interesting book for them to peruse.
Good point. Well said.
Hey, Tammy. And it also...
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go on.
Oh, it also just speaks to that local thing. I mean, you know,
right.
You had nothing to do with the murder of George Floyd, but these are the way, you know, I think it's easier. It makes the problem more accessible and solvable if you can feel, or if you can understand how if it becomes accessible to you by reading about others.
And the way I hear you say that for me is, you start seeing racism, start seeing these little things. I mean, it's hard for, I'll just speak for me, the privileged life that I've had, hard to do that. But when you try to do it, you can start seeing it. And it's rather distressing and eye-opening at the same time. Tammy, before we go on, I want to let our listeners know that we're going to get a list up of these books on the Ramsey County site. Maybe we can get a link from Right on Radio's site. At any rate, so they can access your amazing list. It's going to be a lot longer than we'll have time to talk about. Now I'm sending it back to you. What else do you have on your list?
Okay. Two others that are actually new books and that I'm really excited about. The Whiteness of Wealth by Dorothy A. Brown. Mm-hmm. You can get it at any of your public libraries. And it is and it sounds a little dry, but it is not.
Okay.
It's an expose of the racism that is extant in the American tax system and how taxes discriminate. It goes a little bit into housing and other forms of financial racism that happen in this country. And again, it connects, it's more accessible. You can see this happening. Mm-hmm. You can look at your own wealth and taxes and see how you might have been advantaged and how others might have been disadvantaged. So it's really well written and it's brand new.
Cool. Thank you.
And I highly recommend it. And the other one that kind of goes along with that theme too is called From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century.
I have that.
I've been recommending this a lot because I think this is going to come up a lot. And I think, again, people need to have the language to talk about reparations.
Yes.
If you're across from me and you're saying, reparations, I don't think it's a cool thing. And I'll be like, well, so what have you read about it? What do you know?
Yeah.
Well, nothing. I just know, you know, I think it's something that we're going to really be talking about soon in the future or in the near future. And I think people should have the vocabulary and understanding around discussing that issue, because that does affect all of us.
Yeah.
So those are three things that I think, three book or titles that I think would be great to connect everyone to these issues. And I always like to include, and I did in my list, some humor books.
Oh, thank you.
Just books that talk about generally the Black experience.
Sure.
I do think that these books are aimed at, in a way, they're aimed at Black folks in that you kind of know that you're not alone. So a book like You'll Never Believe What Happened to Lacey, Crazy Stories About Racism by Amber Ruffin and her sister, Lacey Lamar. Amber Ruffin is a writer for Seth Meyers, who took over The Late Show a few years ago. Oh. And it is hilarious. And absolutely all of the racist things that have happened to Lacey have happened to me. I chuckled, I giggled, it was very familiar. But again, she was talking about her daily lived experiences. Mm. And I think that would be great for people that want to understand the tiny cuts, you know, and it's a very gentle way to have some insight into Black, Brown, and Indigenous BIPOC folks,
sure,
you know, encounter in their daily lives that you might not be familiar with. And right, it's right. Great. And it, like I said, it's funny. Another one is how we fight racism, or I'm sorry, how we fight white supremacy by Akiba Solomon and Kenria Rankin. I'm really loving these women. They have another one, another book. Kenria Rankin has Anti-Racism, Powerful Voices, Inspiring Ideas. They are editors at Color Lines, which is an online magazine that addresses issues in Black culture. One thing that I had to put it on a sticky note on my own desk. They basically interview several Black and Brown folks, and they ask them, how do you fight white supremacy? How do you live every day? How do you fight? One that I love, because my friend Lucy, actually, who introduced me to this guy, Jay Smooth, he's a DJ out of New York. And my friend Lucy has the biggest crush on him. He says, I resist white supremacy by loving my people, thinking about systems, and telling the truth. And I think that it just hit a chord with me. And he also gives a great playlist for fighting white supremacy too.
Awesome.
in the book too. So it's some great discussions with a lot of famous people. And another one, for Black and Brown and Indigenous folk, BIPOC that are walking around trying to live these days. It really is across the board, but it's called The Black Fatigue: How Racism Erodes the Mind, Body, and Spirit by Mary Frances Winters. Mm-hmm. I know a popular local book is My Grandmother's Hands by Resma Menachem. Mm-hmm. This is a similar book that talks about how the effects of white supremacy manifest themselves in our bodies and make us sick. And I also think this is a good book for majority populations to read, because again, they have some insight into what's going on. So another one that is on my list that is an excellent book is What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker, memoir and essays by Human Young. And he's the co-founder of Very Smart Brothers, which I think was bought by The Root, who Michael Harriet writes for.
Yeah.
So if you don't know The Root, you should be getting their emails.
Everyone should subscribe to that. I agree. It's fantastic. Yes. It's very funny and very, very to the point. We are down to our last minute, Tammy. I just can't believe it. It's killing me. I want to remind everyone we're speaking with Tammy Lee, our resident librarian for Right on Radio from Ramsey County. And I'm just going to say that I've gotten to know Tammy a little bit between March and now, and it's just been a delight. And we have talked about bringing her back quarterly to talk about all kinds of books, what we should be reading, what's coming up. She has insight into what's coming down the road, and she's so entertaining and so bright, and we just love having her here. Tammy, thank you for this list, and please, when you prepare that list, if you would put that 14-part podcast that you mentioned, or a radio show.
Yes.
That would be lovely if you would do that.
It's Seen on Radio, like S-C-E-N-E, and it's the Whiteness Project, or What is White?
Okay.
Whiteness. So it's a great thing, and yes, I will list it on there as well.
Okay. Thank you, Tammy. What a treat. We'll see you again. Best to you.
Best to you.
And now, take care. Thank you. And now this.
90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Annie Harvey with Right on Radio, and I'm so excited to have Maggie Shipstead here today. Maggie's the author of several novels, most recently Great Circle. Maggie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
For those who haven't had the chance to get their hands on the book yet, could you briefly describe what happens in it?
Yeah, absolutely. Great Circle is primarily about a fictional female pilot named Marion Graves, who disappears in 1950 while trying to fly around the world north-south over the poles. But it starts much earlier and goes through her childhood in Montana and learning to fly in the 20s there. She flies in Alaska in the 30s. She flies in the UK during World War II. And her story is interwoven with that of a modern day movie star named Hadley Baxter, who's playing Marion in a biopic about her life and sort of gets drawn in the question of who Marion really was and what her disappearance kind of means.
This book has everything. Just picture Stefan on SNL. For anyone who hasn't read the book yet and is debating picking up a copy, there's lots of aviation, learning to fly, Old West moonshine bootlegging, Hollywood, tabloids, undercover queer romance, contemporary film stunts, family tragedy, secret children. The book is 600 pages, but to me it felt more like 300 because I was just flying through it. Things kept happening. With all this stuff going on, could you give me a little insight into your research process for this and how you used research to tell this story in a way that's so engrossing and feels so present?
Yeah, well, so I never plan my books. So when I started, I sort of thought that like my other books, I just sort of knocked this off in a year, which turned out to be extremely incorrect. It took 3 years and 3 months to write a first draft. And my first draft was 980 manuscript pages, which is about 25% longer than it ended up being.
Wow.
And I just kind of, I had, the only things I knew were Marion's route around the world, and I decided what kind of plane she would use. And I knew I wanted her to fly during World War II, but I didn't know if I would do that in the US or the UK. So I just sort of started, and then immediately I thought, well, I'll start with an ocean liner sinking or with the launch of an ocean liner. And so then I have to, you know, go get all these books about ocean liners and try and figure out why they sink. And then write that part and then move forward. And that's pretty much my research model throughout the book, was I would come up with some question that I didn't know the answer to or something I needed to write about. And then I would track down the information I needed and sort of use it. And then it kind of goes right out of my head. So it was really pretty organic. And then as I discovered or just came across bits and pieces while I was researching, that would then kind of drive the plot as well. Like there are plenty of left turns just because I came across something that interested me or seemed useful or appropriate. But yeah, it just made it all feel like swimming upstream because I'd make a little bit of progress and then I'd be like, now I have to figure out what Seattle was like in, you know, 1928 or whatever it was. And yeah, it was a lot of work.
That feels very true to the nature of the story in that in the current day track, Hadley, unlike a lot of the people who are making the movie and are coming at things from such a prescriptive lens, like, oh, this is what Marion Graves was. This woman wrote this book about her and we're treating that as definitive for this movie. Hadley is so open and flexible to like, knowing that she'll never know everything about Marion or learning something about Marion and actually like believing and being relieved that the narrative is getting complicated and accepting those non-tight answers. Did you feel kind of like you were having a parallel experience when you were writing it? Or did that ethos writing it play at all into your writing of Hadley's journey?
Oh, interesting. I'm sure subconsciously. I mean, I think I also didn't think through this when I sort of came up with Hadley, which was also semi-accidental. I think I'd been working for 3 or 4 weeks on the book. And then I wrote a section in the book where Hadley is publicly cheating on her movie star boyfriend with a pop star and walks out of a club. And on the surface, it had nothing to do with this aviation thing I was starting to work on, but I sort of felt like it was the missing piece. Mm-hmm. And I think one way in which that ended up being true is that Hadley has this, you know, long-term personal experience of people thinking they know her when they don't, you know, and seeing a picture of her doing something or being somewhere. And then this whole story gets constructed. All these wrong assumptions are made. They spread like wildfire. Mm-hmm. And so I think that in some ways predisposed her to look at the bits and pieces of Marion's life that she can find or has access to and not think that she knows the whole story or not. I think something in her resists sort of filling in the blanks as enthusiastically as everybody else does. And so that was one of the important things about her lens in the book, was just showing, you know, how much is lost when someone disappears or dies. And the reader has this close experience of Marion's life and knows almost about enough as much about Marion as Marion does. And meanwhile, Hadley's like trying to, you know, assemble something out of those pieces, and the reader can see how in some ways futile it is. But, you know, I don't think we never really know other people even when they're still alive. So
yeah, that's so true. So just to dive into that a little deeper, I think that the voice work and the time work in this story was so fascinating and one of my favorite things about it, because you have the pretty immediate, close third person that's describing Marion's life. It feels like a very traditional novel. And then you have the Hadley perspective, which is feels more contemporary. The language is a little like very emotional, a little more sparse in a good way. Like I read through those sections like I was eating popcorn, but still felt them very much. And those together came into, you have a vantage in the past, seeing how things are. You have a vantage in our time, so the future for Marion, trying to decipher things. And the reader is in a fascinating space where they're holding a curated set of information that none of the characters do. Like, we know how Marion will be perceived in the future, but we also know a fair bit about how she felt in the moment. And I was just wondering, how did you, besides that experience you had writing Hadley walking out of the club, how did you choose film specifically and celebrity specifically as the future corollary to Marion's life, especially when there are so many ways to be a public figure in like the internet age, Hollywood very specifically?
Yeah, I mean, some of it was just interest. And I live in LA. And when I started writing the book, I had just moved here. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my friends work in Hollywood. And so it's just so pervasive, that culture in this city, which I find really fascinating. And I had also written a short story that was published in Tin House. I started writing Great Circle in fall 2014. And I think the previous year was when I published this story that was also sort of a intense first person voice of a movie star. And it was playing with sort of familiar tropes, or it was playing with the Katie Holmes, Tom Cruise story and with Scientology. But I sort of reinvented all the vocabulary, and I really enjoyed that process. I thought it was really interesting. I talked to Curtis Sittenfeld for a book event, and she was saying that she feels like when she's writing about public figures, like she's done with Hillary Clinton or Laura Bush, It's like she's talking to the reader about someone they both know, you know, as opposed to if you're talking to a friend and you're telling a story to your friend about someone they don't know, it really changes the feeling. And, yes. And I think that's true. I like sort of having the reader have a running start in the Hadley sections with these little bits and pieces that are sort of familiar and known. But I also think, you know, we get so much of our information about history and past figures through film and TV now, kind of for better or for worse. And I also, you know, I thought a lot about Amelia Earhart in starting the book, because she's sort of, there were many female pilots who were kind of household names in the 20s and 30s, but she's sort of the one we still remember. And it's less about her accomplishments, although they were major, than about her disappearance. I would bet everything I have that she crashed in the ocean and drowned. Like, there's no way anything else happened. But, you know, every few years, somebody digs up something so random and it goes viral, you know, a photo of nothing. And they're like, is this really what happened to Amelia Earhart? It's like, we know what happened to her. And so I think that sort of virality and that confusion of narratives also was indirectly what pushed me toward a Hollywood story. And even looking at, like, the way Amelia Earhart has sort of this game of telephone that happens culturally that conveys a person's life to sort of the general public, I think is really interesting.
Yeah, I would love to dive into the way that patriarchy is so pervasive, both in the Marion thread and in the Hadley thread. And something I really appreciated about this book is that you could say that gender dynamics have changed a lot over the duration of time between Marion's life and Hadley's life, which in some ways is very true. But on the other hand, it's very true that both of them had to interact with male gatekeepers and please male gatekeepers in order to have their career. I'll try not to spoil anything for those who haven't read, but to give a little context, Marion had kind of a patron to help her afford her flight teaching. And then Hadley had to deal with, I'll say it, she had to deal with some kind of greasy studio execs who did not behave especially well in order to get her roles. And I just thought that the way that there was that parallelism, yet also that difference in how patriarchal society prevents smart and capable women from achieving what they can do without that upward punch of male financial or industry patronage. I'll say male gatekeepers across time.
Yeah, male gatekeepers is a great phrase. It kind of arose of its own accord. Like when I started to write the book, I didn't have any thoughts of like, this is how I will weave my feminist agenda into it. Although of course, I think a lot of it was just the practicalities of, okay, this woman or girl, a teenage girl in 1927 decides she wants to be a pilot and she doesn't have, wealthy, supportive parents. She's effectively orphaned. She's raised by her sort of semi-feral childhood, raised by her ne'er-do-well uncle. How do you become a pilot? And, certainly there wasn't some structure of supportive female pilots like looking to help her out. And so she's trying to take lessons and all these men are like, no way, kid, And so she realizes she needs to make money. And how do you do that? And again, that's hard as a girl. And so I think all these obstacles were very concrete and she had to apply a lot of ingenuity and make some very real sacrifices in order to find her way to this thing she knew she had to do. She had to be a pilot and would literally do anything and could kind of talk herself into like the relationship you mentioned with her patron. She sort of was like, this will be fine. I'll be able to get out of this when I need to. And it's a lot more complicated. And, I think too, like in her time period, when she decided she didn't want a domestic life, she didn't want to get married and have children. That's not just one decision you can make. It's this endless series of choices she had to make throughout her life to sort of protect this unorthodox life. And she's constantly vigilant about it at the expense of human connection, even with people who didn't, overtly want to take that away from her. And so then with Hadley, you can, as many people do as celebrities, can look at her and say, well, this is a, extremely rich and famous young white woman. There, she has no problems, no obstacles. And sort of on a certain logistical level, that's true. But what's, Hadley's big sort of problem is just the crushing weight of public scrutiny and how you can never do anything right. Like you can't perform womanhood correctly. You're supposed to be sexy, but not have sex. You're supposed to be interesting, but not be sort of this wrecking ball that she is a little bit. And she's also, as you mentioned, it's for an actress, there's incredible pressure on your body to live up to this male gaze. You mentioned she has sort of a, what we'd now call a Me Too moment with a Harvey Weinstein-esque, not even quite, a much less demonic movie producer. But I think I wrote that before the Weinstein story broke and I've gotten asked about it a lot. And it's like, well, one of the things about Harvey Weinstein is like, even people had no connection to the film industry already knew that guy was like a monster. Like, I think it was a huge bombshell that took journalistic tenacity, like nobody's business, but nobody was surprised. Mm-hmm. Casting couch jokes have been around forever. And in some ways it reminds me of the Catholic Church abuse scandals where it's like altar boy jokes have been around forever. Like people have always known this. It's been in, sort of in the ambient culture. And then at a certain point, like things break and it comes out. So yeah, I think Hadley, yeah, her problems are different than Marion's, but I think that they're both just kind of fundamentally grappling with like, how do I make my life the way I want, being also being a woman? And it's never not complicated.
That segues really nicely into something else that I wanted to ask you about in kind of the women's history section of how I perceive this book. Both Hadley and Marion in their own ways are given much higher kind of quote unquote moral standards to meet in life than men in their communities. They're kind of expected to uphold good behavior as they get increasing amounts of attention and also meet the needs of the men in their life while also being groundbreaking, doing what they do. So they're often blamed for the mistakes of the men that have equal or greater culpability for what has happened. Like, for example, Hadley's affair that kind of imploded the perfect dating situation in which she was dating her movie co-star, or Marion being blamed for her husband's alcoholism instead of, acknowledgement that alcoholism is its own thing. For this kind of women as moral benchmarks phenomenon, how did that play into your story crafting process and your research?
Yeah, that's so interesting. I don't think I've thought about it, but I think it's very true. I think some of it is, men are still very much treated as like the default human experience. And so, of course, men face criticism and judgment and reprobation, all these things. But I don't think it's often in the context of like, well, that's because you're a man, or like, you're not a man, right? And I think that's kind of always lurking for women. It's like in the equation at all times. Marion's uncle who raises her is just a complete and total mess. He's like a degenerate gambler. He's an artist. He has a drinking problem. But I think the way he is perceived, even in that community in the 20s in Montana, is different from how, say, the mother of Marion's best friend, Caleb, is treated, who's also has a drinking problem and is a prostitute. So, yeah, I don't know. It wasn't a big part of my thought process, but I think, you know, just so much about the female experience, once you start writing about women, it finds its way in.
Yeah. To change topics a fair bit, there are a lot of history of aviation benchmarks in addition to a lot of information about planes that Marion wanted or was interested in flying, the World War II planes. How did planes become kind of a central meat of the story, and how did you craft them in a way that felt very present?
Yeah, I'd never been big into airplanes. My brother just left the Air Force after 20 years, and he hasn't flown for a while, but he was a pilot in the Air Force. He flew C-130s. And as a child, he was just obsessed with airplanes, and he could tell what kind, you know, was flying over. He knew everything about them. And I think a lot of people who are pilots just know it's just this thing, like, I must be a pilot. And I never felt that. So when I started writing the book, I had a fair amount of anxiety about, like, can I write about pilots? And I thought about taking flying lessons, and sort of fundamentally, I did not want to. I have like sort of poor spatial relations. None of it's intuitive to me. I thought it would be sort of scary. It's very expensive. But I did go on rides in airplanes when I could. And so, like, I went in a glider and did a loop, which sort of informed how Marion describes flying a loop. And I landed on glaciers and ice sheets. And I was in Missoula once and at the Aviation Museum. And just by chance, these two guys were taking up a 1927 Traveler 6000. And they were like, tell that lady, she can come too.
Ooh.
And I was like, okay. And so, you know, that was completely serendipitous. And I made that the kind of plane that Marion learns how to fly, because I'd ridden around in it in the exact place where she was learning. So I'd seen the sight and I, you know, heard it and smelled it, and I had video of it. But the more I, you know, and I read lots of books by pilots and about pilots, and I used, you know, internet resources like YouTube as well. But, you know, the more I learned about aviation, the more kind of moving I found it, just the speed at which this technology changed the world. And an example I think of all the time is, you know, Charles Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic in 1927 in sort of a glorified laundry basket. And you know, it was this world event and parades, and he's the most famous person in the world. Just this one flight, you know, that's now so ordinary to us. And within his lifetime, he was present at the launch of Apollo 11. So he was there for the moonshot. That shift just in one human lifespan, I think, is really sort of awe-inspiring. As were just kind of those early pilots, they're so adventurous. Reading about them is also a way to see how much the world has changed. Like, they would just sort of land wherever, just in a desert, and hope for the best. And just the wildness of the planet is something that I thought about a lot too.
Yeah. Again, trying not to spoil for folks who haven't read yet, but they land in Antarctica. They're all over Europe. There's so much going on in here, and all of the flight scenes feel very tangible. They feel like a real experience. And flight felt to me like it was the perfect linking force between Marion and Hadley, because they have pretty different personalities, but they're both free thinking, they're autodidactic, they're really avid at doing things on their own, be it reading, exploring, and they both have relationships to tragedies without being defined by their tragedies. And it just felt like solo aviation still has that kind of adventurous connotation even today. And it felt like such a good link.
Thanks. Yeah. You know, I will say one of the hardest, possibly the hardest thing in the revision phase after I'd written my first draft was sort of how to connect these two characters. And so I was mm-hmm. always looking for ways to do that. And through my drafts, I strengthen the sort of concrete coincidences they have. Like they're yeah. both orphans, they're both raised by uncles. And it was less about doing anything cutesy and more just about creating a reason why Hadley would sort of look at Marion as having something to do with her. Like I think Hadley yeah. is fundamentally a self-absorbed person, as she inevitably would be growing up as a child actor. And she's like, she thinks the universe is sending her messages and this is one. But I had different versions. You know, there was a draft where Hadley and this producer she works with, Redwood, are like in a library, like going through files and like digging up stuff on Marion, but that was like too sort of on the nose and literal. And, uh-huh. and so, yeah, it was this sort of kind of the last thing that fell into place with the book was having enough, but not too much Hadley, and having their connection be close enough, but not too tidy. So yeah, I yeah. think flight, or even just a sort of a metaphorical sensation of flight, was something I was sort of trying to put in there.
Yeah, it felt to me like the connection between Hadley and Marion came out balanced really nicely. And then I think they each had nice foils within their own lives. Like I really enjoyed the parts about Jamie. For those who haven't read, Marion has a very pacifistic, exploratory brother who doesn't really understand her, but participates in her life and goes on his own adventures. And it feeds really nicely into her story. For revising this book down hundreds and hundreds of pages, is there anything that you wish could have been in or could have been done differently? Or do you feel like you came down to something that you really feel settled on? That may be a weird question, and feel free to take it where you want.
No, not at all. I mean, I think part of the reason I'm able to publish books is that at a certain point I go, okay, this is done. And mm-hmm. then I don't really let myself second guess it. So I cut 230 manuscript pages. And most of that was done doing small pervasive cuts. Just a book that long, you cut a little bit on each page and you end up cutting a yeah. lot of pages. There was one section that we cut that I missed. I think it was absolutely the right decision to cut it. But there are these sections called incomplete histories, you know, that zip through sort of long periods of time. And there was one for Antarctica, but it came very late in the book, right before their flight. And my editor was like, you know, people have read 500 pages, aren't going to be excited when it's like Pangea, you know, and goes back millions of years. And you're like, oh, I just want to know what happens. I don't want to know about the movements of the tectonic plates. So that one I miss a little bit. There was also, Jamie had a different storyline for a while that involved him joining a religious community in Canada called the Jukabors. And they're sort of like Russian Quakers. They're communal, they're pacifists, they're vegetarian, they're Christian, but don't use the Bible. It's all sort of sung prayer. Really interesting people. And my editor was like, this is just one sort of weird thing too many. So that got cut. And then I had to sort of reconstruct his plot line. But yeah, I think, you know, it's just nothing's ever perfect. And, you know, no one ever wishes they published a book sooner, like an earlier draft. The thought of that horrifies me. And I'm sure I could have done more. But also it was like, it's now been 7 years since my last book was published. And it was just, you know, it was time.
Yeah. When you finish a huge project like this, do you immediately start working on another project usually?
I mean, maybe in a perfect world. Seating Range, I sold Astonish Me right before Seating Arrangements was published. So my second book and my first book. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of happenstance. Like Astonish Me was a short story I was trying to revise. And then it just sort of blurped out into a short novel. I wrote it from start to selling it in 5 months. So super, super fast, which gave me misguided thoughts about how quickly Great Circle would go. But then a lot of time elapsed between finishing Astonish Me and really starting Great Circle, although I'd had the idea of a female pilot for a couple years, just with no elaboration. And, you know, also like when I finished the drafts with my editor, then I have to do copy edits and I have to do page proofs. And so that takes a few months. But now, I mean, I had started something kind of earlier in the pandemic that just sort of fizzled. And then kind of 2 months before Great Circle was published, I started something that I think will stick. Mm-hmm. But I only had time to write 65, 70 pages. And then kind of now I'm much too busy. So I'll definitely be going back to that. And I wish I had more, but I also realized I was really depleted by this book. Like I put a lot in it. And so that was hard. And then also just facing a blank page after at least having been working with something for 6 years, that was really daunting.
Is the next book you're working on also something that's intensely research-based?
I certainly hope not. As I've started it, it's more of a modern story about a family in LA, and I can feel it sort of starting to sprawl a little bit, and I'm trying to sort of like rein it in. I'm like, we will not be writing another 1,000-page manuscript. And I also just, you know, it's important to me to have a lot of variation in my projects. All my books have been different from each other. All my short stories are quite varied. I have a short story collection coming out next summer. So yeah, I'm always looking for change. And I think too, I just wouldn't try to match this book with my next one. So yeah, I'm sort of purposely trying to scale down.
Cool. Well, I, for one, I'm so excited to see what you do next. And I really appreciate you joining us. For those who started listening partway through, you're listening to KFAI 90.3 FM. You've been listening to Maggie Shipstead talk about her new book, Great Circle, which is available now. Maggie, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Are listening to Write on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Tammy Lee and Maggie Shipstead, plus our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Write on Radio at kfai.org/program/writeonradio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our podcast. Find it on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, anywhere else you get your podcasts.